And this is a very difficult job. If you're right, 65% of the time, you are going to produce an incredible track record over the years. But it also means you are going to be wrong 35% of the time. And for most people getting into this, you're coming from a world where you got A's on tests, right? You're used to 90-something percent, and 65 doesn't feel very good. And I do think there's a challenge that a lot of new investors have, which is, how do you balance protecting your ego with thinking clearly and doing the right thing for clients? And nobody realizes that they're doing it. It is subconscious. But you're making decisions that sometimes are likely ego-based. And the important lesson, I think, is you got to learn when you're lying to yourself, right? It is hard to admit even to yourself that you are wrong. But you have to develop a sense for it so you can identify it.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? The opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Alex Fitch. Alex is the director of U.S. research at Harris Oakmark, and he is also the portfolio managers of the Oakmark Select Fund, the Oakmark Equity and Income Fund, and the U.S. Concentrated Strategy. Alex, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome to AUM.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Let's start with your background, your career. I guess, when did you kind of first discover that you had a knack or an interest for investing?
I wouldn't say that anyone's born with a knack for investing, actually. I think a lot of investors early on might think they have a knack for investing until the market quickly corrects that view. I think it is very much a skill set that is honed over time and through experience and often through mistakes. And, you know, as Munger put it, hopefully other people's mistakes, but oftentimes a lot of your own mistakes. I do think I've always been inclined towards investing. I still remember first time I found out that a bank will pay me interest on my savings account and how fascinating of an idea that was. And I vividly remember going through compound interest math and seeing the magic that that can create over time. And I was always interested in things that were similar to value investing, but maybe not exactly value investing. You know, I collected sports cards and I would obsess over these magazines showing the fair values of my card collection. I'd go to card auctions at the card store and try to buy a bargain, or go to school and try to maximize the value of my binder. And that wasn't value investing, but it was a lot like value investing. It did take me a while to find the real thing. I knew that I was very interested in markets and I was interested in stocks, but I arguably wasted a lot of years reading books on technical analysis or trading strategies or options strategies. And one day I came across Margin of Safety by Seth Klarman, and it was like a switch just flipped and I was set. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I was going to be a value investor, and I've been pursuing it ever since.
How did you get connected with Harris? I guess at what time frame, what age did you kind of discover that knack, and how long until you found Harris?
Yeah, well, it was shortly after Margin of Safety. I started reading every book I could get my hands on. There's a book by Marty Whitman called Value Investing. And at the very end of the book, Marty listed a whole bunch of firms that he admired. And so I wrote down the list and started researching these firms. And Oakmark was one of the names on the list. And I pretty quickly realized that that was where I wanted to work. I really liked the way that our CIO, Bill Nygren, talked about the team investment process. I liked the way he talked about the value philosophy and this idea that growth and value are not different investing styles, but just two components of the same style. And what really matters is buying at a discount. And so I decided I was targeting Harris. And in hindsight, maybe I put too much pressure on myself for achieving that goal because I realized I had one shot at this and I did not want to use my bullet until I knew I was actually going to hit my target. And so I decided that I had to get ready first. And so I spent the next few years actually reading value investing books, investing personally, practicing, coming up with a thesis and doing the research. I took the first two levels of the CFA. I actually started work in investment banking with the idea that I needed that modeling and valuation work to succeed at Harris Oakmark. And ultimately, finally, at long last, decided that I was ready. I reached out to a portfolio manager named Kevin Grant. He was a PM on the Oakmark Fund at the time. And he took my call and he invited me to come in for interviews. And by some incredible stroke of luck, it worked out.
Nice. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, you joined Harris around 2011.
Yeah, 2011.
Curious, if you go back to you're looking at the Alex Fitch from 2011 versus today, do you think you've changed at all as an investor over the years? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think I've changed dramatically. I've been grown from nothing into something. Broadly, I would say that investors are built more so than they're born. And I've definitely been built by Harris Associates over the years. If you think about early investors, they tend to, not always, but often get a lot of comfort from what looks like really important information. But when you dig in deeper, it turns out to not be that meaningful. And I think the classic example is the model, where an investor will put together a model with plausible assumptions. It'll show that a company is undervalued and they'll get a lot of comfort from that. They'll then look to sell side consensus or management's long-term targets. And because those things align with the model, that confidence and comfort will only be enhanced. And then there's a tendency to absorb and really parrot the market or company narrative on a given stock. And that package can be very confidence inspiring for an investor early on in their career. The really interesting thing about it to me is that as you gain experience, you come to realize how that's not very meaningful. I mean, the Munger advice of, invert, always invert, I think is important here. Every company that's widely traded has a bid and an ask. And behind those bids, there's probably a valuation model that has plausible inputs that suggest it's undervalued. And every management team has targets for how they're going to improve a business. That is, it is almost a career imperative for them. And if they don't, you'd have to, as a shareholder, say, what are we paying you for? And they all have a narrative, right? If a company doesn't have a narrative, they'll make one. They have investor relations teams whose job is to create that narrative. And so if most every company has all three components that were underpinning your idea thesis, what did you really have? You know, what is the thesis? And so I think that is the progression for an investor, is going from this kind of checklist-based fact gathering to really using judgment and saying, okay, the model assumptions are plausible, but are they reasonable? Are they right? Management has these targets, but should we believe them? There's this narrative around the company, but does it make sense? And asking those questions, developing that judgment is a natural evolution, and it's the one that I've been through over my 14 years here. And it's subtle, but it really is important.
Yeah, I like that. It's this investor relations, those nice, pretty investor relations presentations can be a little misleading at times. Let's dig into Harris's process, or Harris Oakmark's process overall. I guess I dug into it a bit with Bill and during our conversation, but I want to get kind of your view on things and kind of how you see it as well. What do you think makes Harris's research process unique compared to other investment firms?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the team-based culture. Going back to this idea that investors are built and not born, if we were going to have a tagline at Harris for recruiting, I would say it is that we build great investors. And that is a direct result of the culture that Bill and others before me created that we're still maintaining today. And the idea is that you take these 15 or so people that are extremely passionate and extremely smart and who all share this identical underlying investment philosophy that a stock is a partial ownership stake in a business, that the value of the business is driven by the cash flows. But they have different ways of viewing the world, right? They have their own lens and their own way of thinking. And you set them down at the table and you essentially say, go to war, you know, get to the truth. And you end up with these 15 very smart people challenging each other, calling each other's bluffs, asking probing questions from different perspectives. It's a process that sharpens the team in a way that's very hard to replicate. And you think about a lot of firms, there is a tendency to avoid challenging your boss, right? You don't want to offend the person that pays you. Come. And my colleague, Mike Nicholas, likes to talk about it as inverse career risk at Harris, that at Harris, the big career risk is not challenging your boss, that it doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, if you have something important to say, it should be said. And we're not going to pull punches. We do want to punch the idea and not the person. And so that is the process. And I think it drives intellectual honesty. It helps us uncover blind spots. And importantly, it really does drive this continuous learning where everyone on the team is being challenged every day. And if you look at the history of value investment firms, there have been a lot of firms that have died over time, that have failed. And in most of those cases, it's because they didn't evolve their process. I think that our culture of challenging each other like that, it makes it very difficult to reject new ideas and to avoid evolving. I think the evolution is kind of a natural consequence of that.
Yeah, I think from the outside looking in, it can sound a little combative, but I think that intellectual tension, I imagine, kind of helps arrive at some real truths and helpful opinions about the business.
And we are a very close group. I mean, it sounds combative. It is combative in the moment, but it's combative about an idea, right? It's an intellectual debate. And afterwards, we'll all go to lunch together, joke around, start talking about different topics. And we are a very tight-knit group.
Nice. And when I spoke with Bill, he mentioned that most of the Harris analyst team are all, they're generalists. For you as a portfolio manager, are you giving them any sort of direction in terms of ideas or industries you want them researching, or is it you just leave it totally open-ended to them?
There are cases in which we will ask someone to look at an idea. And so maybe we have prior experience with a CEO, and we think that he or she is a good person to invest alongside. And so that's worth looking in. So we'll ask an analyst to take a look. The other common instance is where there's an industry or a sector where we haven't seen any ideas in a long period of time. And in those situations, we might ask an analyst to take a look at the industry and comb through the names and figure out if there's anything we've been missing and anything that's attractive there. Ultimately, though, at the end of the day, it's still the analyst's call if they want to present that idea. And, you know, they have to own the decision. And so in the vast majority of cases, the idea sourcing is done by the analyst team. And the bet that we're making inherently in that is that this team of generalists turning over rock after rock after rock across industries is going to do a better job of telling us which sectors are attractive through that bottom-up work than a top-down portfolio manager with some broader market view could. It's our own miniature version of capitalism where, you know, rather than centralizing the decision-making and say, here's what you produce, we are distributing it and saying, here's your incentive, now produce what sells. And our opinion is that works a lot better.
Are you, as a portfolio manager, still sourcing ideas regularly as well?
I am. I spend less of my time on it than I used to, but the vast majority of us on the team are analysts and portfolio managers. And there is something about staying close to the analyst's work and being engaged in it that I think adds value for a portfolio manager.
Yeah, I can imagine. I want to shift gears a little bit to, I guess, some of the actual companies and ideas you're looking for at Harris Oakmark. I guess just a high level view, what are the kind of characteristics that the team is looking for in a potential portfolio company?
Yeah. Well, you know, as I mentioned, we only do one thing. It's value investing. And it's the only thing we've done for almost five decades. And the core of that is that we're buying stocks for less than what they are worth. And so we're essentially trying to buy as much future free cash flow as possible per dollar of capital that we are deploying today. And so that discount to intrinsic value, it's our number one criteria. It is our North Star. Now, you could make the argument, and I think it's a good one, that everything has a price, right? It doesn't matter if it's a dying retailer or some growing technology company. The cash that comes out all spends the same. So if you can find something trading for less than what it's worth, that should be an eligible idea. For the most part, we agree with that, with one big caveat, which is that some situations are so disadvantageous for investors that we just outright avoid them. If you have a management team that is not aligned with shareholders, it really doesn't matter what your model says about the upside to intrinsic value. I mean, if that upside is going to be redeployed into value destructive activities, it's going to evaporate. You're never going to be able to capture it. And so in addition to that discount to intrinsic value, we insist that we are investing alongside managers that think and act like owners, where their capital allocation decisions are going to grow per share value over time. Beyond that, the whole universe is addressable. And, you know, you've seen us historically have a lot more eclectic of a portfolio than a lot of value managers. You know, we don't have any quantitative screen that says we're only going to own companies below X PE ratio. We don't have some macro overlay saying we want to own this type of company today. Some of our value investments grow quickly. Some don't, but all of them are value investments.
Yeah, and looking through the various portfolios, it's hard to like pinpoint a single theme or sector, or like the companies are kind of all over the universe. Something you guys have talked about publicly is your use of mid-cycle earnings. For anyone not familiar with that, how do you define mid-cycle earnings, and then why is it an important part of the valuation process for you?
It starts with a decision that we make around modeling. You think about any business valuation, it is inherently a discounted cash flow analysis, whether the investor realizes it or not. There is an implicit DCF behind any multiple. The trouble is that a black box DCF is not particularly confidence inspiring. And if you instead value businesses on a price to earnings multiple, you get this whole world of context and comparability. You can now compare against private market transactions. You can compare against the trading history. You can compare against peers, which is useful as a sense check. And so even though ultimately everything is hinging upon a DCF, explicitly or implicitly, we like to express it in terms of normalized earnings. Now, for a cyclical business, that multiple really only matters if it's applied to the mid-cycle earnings. And so if you think about, you know, our time horizon, we know that during our holding period, there are going to be good times and bad times. And it'd be a mistake to think that either of those will last forever, right? In reality, we are going to get some of both. And so we need to account for that. I like to use the coin flip analogy. You can picture this coin where in any given year, it's going to be flipped. And if it lands heads, you're going to earn $1. And if it lands tails, you're going to earn $0. The fair multiple for that business could be 10 times earnings. It would be a mistake to apply it to any individual year's earnings, though. And that business would be overvalued at $10 per share. It'd be undervalued at $0. And the right way to value it is to base it on the expected value of the coin flip. And if you did a DCF on all of those coin flips, that's the answer that you'd come up with. So that's what mid-cycle means to us. That's an extremely oversimplified example, but it is representative of situations we come across. There are a lot of companies where we won't be able to guess with much accuracy what the earnings might look like in 2026. But like the coin flip, we think we understand the distribution of those outcomes and the range of outcomes. And so we might have much more confidence about the average earnings over the next 5 to 10 years. And even though the company might never earn that average and the coin never pays 50 cents, that is the right earnings level to underpin our valuation.
So a couple follow-ups. In terms of sort of the outcome distribution, are you guys willing to pay a little more for a narrower set of outcomes? Like, are you willing to kind of pay up for more certainty there, or are you just looking for a bigger discount and it's when it's harder to judge?
Yeah, two things. I'd say first, position sizing is a part of the way that we deal with that. The narrower the range of outcomes, the larger we'll size a position within the portfolio. Then you start to talk about the trade-offs between, you know, X position sizing. How much better is it to have a narrow 15% upside versus a very wide 50? And we do penalize businesses in their valuation via the discount rate for that wider range of outcomes. And actually what we found over time is that we don't do that enough, that the surprises are more frequent for these companies with the wider ranges of outcomes, and they tend to be skewed negatively. More random bad things happen than good things. And so it's an important adjustment, even just for getting our values into the right spot.
Are you getting to a mid-cycle earnings figure on every business? Like, is that a part of the valuation process for every company, or is it just the quote-unquote cyclicals?
In theory, we're doing it for every business, but there are a bunch where, it, practically speaking, it doesn't matter that much. All right, if you're valuing a very stable consumer packaged goods company, there's not going to be much of an adjustment for the cycle. Now, if you're valuing a bank, there can be a very large adjustment for the cycle. And so in every instance, we want it to be on the same set of assumptions and the same mid-cycle assumptions, but it matters a lot more in some cases than others.
Okay, I want to ask about the sell discipline as well. How do you, I guess a couple questions here. How do you determine when it's time to sell a position, especially one where you've had multiple expansion while owning it? Is it ever purely valuation based, or are you looking for some other kind of traits to make that decision?
We don't talk that much actually about multiple expansion, which that might seem surprising, but it's really not how we view the world. There's a fluid trade-off between earnings growth and multiple expansion. And if you're predicting earnings growth, the further you look out into the future, the less multiple expansion per se that you're going to be forecasting. And we do like the comfort and the check that comes from saying this company has traded at this type of multiple historically. But there are plenty of instances where we're investing in a business that has never traded as high as we think it should be valued at, where we're saying that the earnings growth justifies this. And even if it never trades there, you still get the returns, right? You just get it through the earnings growth each year being slightly better than what that multiple implied. And so you're earning it the hard way, essentially. There's a high bar for those ideas, but they can be attractive ideas. As for the sell discipline, there are really three reasons that we sell. The first and probably our favorite reason is that the stock hits our sell target. So we don't subscribe to this idea that there is no price too high for a wonderful business. Right? In our view, there's a fair price for everything. And history is just riddled with examples of what looked like wonderful businesses with long growth runways that eventually got disrupted. You know, trees don't grow to the sky. Buffett shows those tables showing that the largest companies in 1 year are hardly ever the largest companies 10 years later. And so we are glad to sell a stock when it hits our sell target, which is typically 90 to 95% of our estimate of intrinsic value. The second reason we'll sell a stock is that we have better opportunities that we can shift into. And so we're very happy to sell an 80-cent dollar to buy a 40-cent dollar. Right? We are increasing the potential for excess returns in the portfolio, and we're improving the margin of safety. So that's a trade-off we'll absolutely make. The last reason for selling, and I think one that a lot of investors struggle with, is because we decide that we were wrong. And that is very difficult, right? It is natural to anchor, natural in this business, and there's a lot of incentive for it. You've talked publicly about a name, potentially you've talked to clients. It can be painful to admit that you were wrong. And oftentimes in these situations, the stock is lower than it was when you purchased it, which adds incremental baggage. We've tried to create a process around mistake management to deal with that. and to try to fight that inclination. And so when we look back at our history, what we can see is that when fundamentals start diverging from our estimates, and when value growth starts either meaningfully lagging or meaningfully exceeding our expectations, that tends to persist. A big shortfall is usually followed by yet another shortfall. And what we do in response is we closely track those fundamentals and those value estimates. And when you see the first significant divergence, we ask the analyst to bring the name back in front of the team so we can debate it as a group once again. If we decide that we want to keep owning the name, it stays on our approved list and in portfolios. But on the second shortfall, we then have a devil's advocate. So one of our analysts will spend weeks researching the idea, coming up with the bear case, and then we'll present it to the team. And then we'll hash it out as a group, go to war again over the idea. On the third instance, we'll transfer coverage. We just want to make sure we have a fresh look. And at any point in that process, at any of those three steps, the name can be voted off of our approved list by our stock selection group and sold from portfolios. And so it's giving us this mechanism to first make sure that we're vetting these names in this problem area as much as we should be. And then second, for dealing with it and the path towards exiting.
Yeah, I imagine that's helpful for everyone on the team to have an actual process that you're able to go through to determine kind of maybe did we take a step in the wrong direction kind of thing. I wanted to ask, because you mentioned earlier, one of the big pillars of what you're looking for is operators that act like owners. What are some of the judging management is always kind of one of the hardest things in investing, I think, because, you know, you don't get up to the top without being, you know, charismatic and being able to sell and all that. So I guess, what are some of the characteristics that you look for in management teams that you want to pair your capital with?
Yeah, it is a difficult part of the job. In an ideal world, you have a long track record to study and you can see prior decisions. That's not always the case, though. We very much believe incentives matter. We like to see situations in which management can participate in the upside along with shareholders, but then they also need to participate in the downside. And we get frustrated with these compensation plans that are essentially heads I win, tails I don't lose, where you participate in the upside, but you still do very well even if your shareholders don't. We want to see the outcomes for the managers and the shareholders linked. It's always nice to see skin in the game. We want to see strong ownership from the management team, which helps further that first goal. And then more broadly, we want to understand what their goals are. What are they really trying to achieve here? And in our view, the best way to do that is to take them off script. Right? The managers are prepared for the vast majority of questions that they receive, and they've usually received them relatively recently. And so we want to talk about things that, first off, most investors are not talking about, and less so because we care about that particular topic, and more because we want to understand how they think. And we want to know, do the actions tie with the reasoning here? And is the reasoning logical? And what is it revealing about this person's motivations and goals? And so we're trying to understand what makes them tick. And it's a difficult process, but we find that an unconventional approach to it usually works better.
Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Yeah, I imagine you get more genuine responses and really can see how they think. You mentioned something earlier that I really liked, which was on any stock, you've got a bid and an ask on both the bid, you've got a model with all plausible scenarios, and on the ask, you've got other investors that have models with plausible scenarios. How important is that why to you behind a company's undervaluation?
Oh, yeah, it's very important. If you don't understand the why, you are running the risk of essentially winning bids that you don't want to win, right? I mean, you can think of it a lot like insurance. If you're writing insurance for a risk that you don't fully understand, it's not good news when you start winning the business. There is major potential for adverse selection there. And so we very much want to understand the why. We spend a lot of time talking about the why. It is not always all that satisfying, though. You know, sometimes the why is we have a different time horizon than most of the market today, that these benefits are 4 years into the future and, you know, there's expectations for a downturn in the interim, something along those lines. And so we're prioritizing both solutions here. One, trying to understand that why as best we can. And then two, making sure that the analyst has done the deep work and covered all the bases so that there isn't some unexpected reason that explains the low price in hindsight.
Makes sense. On the cyclicals side of things, and we're going to go through some specific business questions here in a second, but looking through the portfolios, you guys do not shy away from cyclicals. I'm curious how you get a sense of where a company is at in the cycle. What does that research process look like? Is it like industry-wide research, or is it the bottoms-up approach? I'm thinking about John Deere, which I believe I've seen in the portfolio, and you kind of have this, it's a great business, and it's proven that it's a great business, but it's running into some headwinds here. How do you look at it if you know that there's potentially some headwinds in front of it?
Yeah. It's a good question. First off, I agree with your comment that we have not been afraid of cyclicals. And it's interesting because over the last 5 to 10 years, there have been a number of periods in which we found cyclicals to be very attractive and shifted the portfolios in that direction. That, through our longer-term history, has not always been the case. There have been long periods of time in our history where we owned consumer packaged goods at multiples below a market multiple. And as the opportunity set changes, we change. And that has, in recent years, pushed us, at least in certain environments, towards cyclicals. I think that is at least partly a reflection of how the market's changed. There is a lot of money at institutional investors with very short time horizons. And really, even for the professionals, it's not necessarily driven by their own inclinations. Ultimately, your time horizon ends up being the same as the time horizon of your clients. And so if you have short-term oriented clients that are expecting a certain performance over certain periods of time, that's going to influence your decision-making. And I think that it seems to us like that's become such a large portion of the market today that it's creating these opportunities where you can find a cyclical business that is on the cusp of or in the midst of some cyclical downturn that are trading at these unusually low multiples of mid-cycle earnings and look like obvious bargains. We have the luxury of having investors that share our time horizon. I think that's been developed through years of communication from people like Bill. And that enables us to take advantage of these and say, in the case of John Deere, for instance, we might be entering an ag downturn. Maybe there will be a few years of tough orders, but it doesn't really matter to business value whether that downturn came today or came 3 years from now. And we knew it was eventually going to happen. There's no situation in which we'd never saw another downturn. And so on a mid-cycle basis, if it's undervalued, that can be a really compelling opportunity. And we're lucky enough to have the client base where we can wait it out. To your first point on understanding where companies are in the cycle, there are really two approaches. I'd say we have a top-down lens and we have a bottom-up lens. And the top-down lens is simple. It is saying that on average, our best guess is that the economy is going to be about average. You know, the average GDP growth, average interest rates, average housing starts. And that is almost never a controversial opinion, except for at extremes. And there are moments like 2008 or like 2020, where saying that the world will be average again is actually a bullish take. But for the most part, that's not the differentiator. From a bottom-up perspective, What we really want to understand is, first, how is a company going to perform in that type of average backdrop? Second, in the bad periods, can they survive, right? Do they have the balance sheet and the financial wherewithal that even if this goes on for years, that they will be okay? And then equally importantly, what are the guardrails around the company's returns? For most businesses, there is something of a floor and something of a ceiling on the returns that the business is going to generate, right? There's a level of returns where you are going to invite competition, where the earnings are just too high relative to the replacement cost. Capacity is going to enter the market and compete those returns back down. And the opposite's also often true, that there's a certain level of earnings where capacity is going to exit the market. Companies are going to leave. They're going to shut down. And they're going to do that until the returns come back up. And so you can get that set of guardrails. And that can be pretty informative when you start thinking about stress testing some of the broader macroeconomic variables, right? If interest rates are 3% or 7%, how much does it ultimately change bank earnings power? Or do they get competed back to that low teens return on equity that they've earned historically? So it's that type of bottom-up analysis that is probably the biggest driver of our cyclical valuations.
Okay, let's dig into a couple, I guess, industry/business specific questions. Going through the Oakmark Select Fund specifically, I see a number of software businesses, Salesforce, Paycom, I think maybe you could group Airbnb in there as well, that investors could say trade at optically expensive earnings multiples. There might be investors on either side of the fence there, but why do you think, I guess, what do you think investors often get wrong about valuing these software businesses?
I think it goes back to the comment earlier on how important it has been for Harris Oakmark to evolve over time in order to continue performing at a high level, and the history that's littered with these failed value investing firms. The reality is, and I think everyone agrees with this, that growth requires investment. In almost all cases, you need to spend more to earn more. And that's true whether you're a retailer and opening new locations that are not going to mature for some period of time. That's true if you're building a consumer brand through advertising. It's true if you're building a software company by growing your sales force. And what's changed in the economy is that the growth used to be driven by investments in tangible assets. So you'd go and you'd build a new factory. And the accounting was such that you'd capitalize that on the balance sheet and you'd depreciate it. And investors could still look at your income statement and understand the future earnings power or the current earnings power of the business. And what's changed is that so much of this investment today, which is still long-dated growth investment with a long useful life in many cases, becomes expensed immediately. And that's true when you're building a brand. That's true for R&D, if you're developing whatever software product you're going to sell or technology hardware. And it's true for sales expenses. If you can bring a new sales rep on who goes and sells to clients that have a 10-year life after they sign the contract, you're expensing the entire sales rep cost against your current earnings, but the revenue is coming over a decade. There is a mismatch. And so that breakdown in the accounting has, I think, confused a lot of investors about what the mature economics for these businesses look like. And that's the case for all the names that you listed, where we believe that they're significantly more profitable than the income statement shows today. And that when we go through and recast those financials, at the time that we were buying Salesforce or with Airbnb, with Alphabet, that we were paying a below market multiple for what is a great fast growth business, just through changing our treatment of these longer term investments that are called expenses.
Interesting. Yeah, I imagine there are so many costs, whether it's just pure developers, or like you said, those sales reps, where it really kind of obfuscates the actual valuation that or the earnings of the business that's underlying it.
In a number of cases, these businesses are also relatively immature, and there are a lot more opportunities than we're used to with older companies. If you were a manufacturer historically, it wasn't obvious what incremental business lines you could expand into. If you're Alphabet and you have this great search engine, there's a whole host of different business lines that can be built off of that, that might slightly integrate with that, where you have an advantage. Or for Airbnb, where travel is being booked through your platform, what else can you possibly sell? All right, for Salesforce now adopting and creating these AI tools. So it's not only that the investment takes capital and that capital gets expensed, it's also that there is more to do here, and for good reason. And so as long as the growth spend seems to be high return, it's something that investors should like.
You mentioned Alphabet there, and I want to talk about them. And it's really kind of a timely, time to be talking about Alphabet. They just had, I believe it was their some sort of a presentation where they've guided for, I think, $75 billion in CapEx for 2025. And for context for listeners, they spent $32 billion in CapEx in 2023. So a lot of people have already been talking about this, but they're ramping CapEx very quickly. Do these heightened investments change the way that you look at or value Alphabet in any way? I guess we just talked about expensing instead of capitalizing. And in this case, it's kind of potentially changing that equation. Does it adjust anything for you overall with Alphabet, and then maybe just overall views on this heightened investment period?
Yeah, it certainly is an enormous increase in capital spending first, both from Alphabet and Alphabet's peers. And it adds uncertainty, right? There is risk with deploying this much capital incrementally. And we don't know the returns. Now, it is not in isolation a bad thing, and actually it can be a very good thing, right? Deploying even more capital at very high rates of return is a wonderful thing for a business to have the opportunity to do. And the question is just, what are the returns ultimately on that investment spend? We do often find opportunities in situations like this where we can get comfortable on the return of the capital spending. ConocoPhillips is a holding of ours, and it's a oil company making long-term investments in projects that will come online in the late 2020s or 2030s while sustaining their current production through other spending. And what we found is that analysts, by and large, are overlooking the long-tailed benefits that are going to come from all that capital spending and valuing them at about the same free cash flow multiple as every other oil company today, despite the fact that so much of it is this long-dated investment. Charter Communications is another example where Charter is expanding its footprint through these rural line extensions. They will ultimately increase Charter's free cash flow, and its broadband business today depresses free cash flow. And it seemed to create an opportunity for us where we can buy it at a very low multiple of what we think free cash flow looks like in 2027 or 2028. And so from a time horizon perspective, this can be a fruitful hunting ground for us. The question for Alphabet is, what are the returns on this incremental spending? So far, what we've assumed is that this is just the cost of doing business now, that this incremental capital spend is not going to drive some acceleration in cloud revenue growth, that we're still on the old trajectory. The spend is still attractive if you view it on that basis. And the idea, our basis for that is saying that we don't want to give credit for incremental growth driven by this spend until we see more evidence of adoption of the underlying AI use cases. So make sure that it will drive the incremental demand first. But with the way Alphabet's viewed today, if the spend works and the growth accelerates, that is upside to our value estimates. If it doesn't work, you're still looking at a company that's trading for meaningfully less than what it's worth, where management will inevitably at some point pull back on the incremental low return CapEx, and where you're paying a low double-digit earnings multiple for the core search business after dealing with all the various business segments and their net cash.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique approach. I feel like I haven't heard a lot of people mention that, which is even if we assume this doesn't accelerate the business, you're still, the returns on invested capital still look pretty good. And on the other side, on the flip side, if it does surprise to the upside, now you've got a company that's historically had great returns that seems to have found an area where they can actually sort of a huge reinvestment runway potentially. Another company I want to talk about, which is very different, is Lithium Motors. I've heard you mention them a couple times publicly. That might be a name that listeners are actually unfamiliar with, which is surprising considering how good the returns have been over the last 10 to 20 years. Can you give us an overview of this business and the acquisition strategy that they've got? Yeah, and then what do you think investors misunderstand about Lithia?
Yeah. Lithia is a good example of a business that has deployed enormous amounts of capital over a long period of time at very high returns. So for background, Lithia is the largest automotive retailer in the country. They own franchise dealerships. They have more stores than AutoNation today, although they're less of a household name. And that, you know, 15 years ago, certainly wasn't the case. He went back to 2011, Lithia was earning about $2 per share. That's about the time that Brian DeBoer took over as CEO. And what Brian did is really focus Lithia on this idea of consolidating the industry through accretive acquisitions of dealerships. And the history has been that they're value investors, that they're buying underperforming dealers where they can improve the operations, generally paying a mid-single digit multiple of earnings, which falls even lower after the earnings are improved. And Brian's been executing on that formula for almost 15 years now. You've seen earnings per share grow from $2 per share to $35 per share this year. And the stock has vastly outperformed the S&P 500 during his tenure. And I think it's been a series of proof points for this acquisition strategy. And yet today, Lithia still trades for just 8 times current year earnings. To your point on it being off of most investors' radars and maybe relatively unappreciated, I think the hardest question for investors to answer when they are looking at a roll-up is what is going to prevent these returns from getting competed away, right? If there is an attractive opportunity to deploy capital in a competitive market with a lot of money in private equity, why won't the acquisition prices get pushed up to the point that the returns fall to a fair level? And the really interesting thing about the franchise dealership business is that that money really can't enter the space. The ecosystem prevents it. And it's because if you think about these franchise dealerships, these are the retail customer-facing arm of the manufacturers. Right? This is their touch point, and they care a lot about how that relationship is managed, how it's handled. And they put various rules in place as a result. And one of those rules is that if you're going to buy or sell a dealership, the manufacturer has to approve it. And the manufacturer is not going to approve anyone coming in and buying a dealership. I mean, they want to know that you're going to be able to outsell your fair share in the area. They want to know that your customer experience scores will be high. They want to know that you'll have people coming back for service and coming back to buy their next car and building brand loyalty. And so the good operators tend to get approval for these transactions. New entrants tend to be excluded. And so it's kept the market limited, you know, for deals limited to just Lithia and the large peers. And this is an extremely fragmented market. You're talking about 17,000 dealerships. The largest players still have low single-digit percentage market share. And Lithia in particular has made this the focal point of their operations for a long period of time. You know, if you talk to DeBoer about M&A, he'll tell you that of the 17,000, they know exactly which 2,500 dealerships they want to own, that they've reached out to them, that with many of them, they have existing relationships, and that they'll be the first phone call whenever that store goes to market. That takes time to build. And in an extremely fragmented market, oftentimes they are the only phone call. And so it's enabled this compounding at this attractive rate for such a long period of time. And yet even today, it still doesn't seem to be priced in.
So we're talking about this at kind of a unique point in time because there's, as we're discussing this, there's a lot of news that's changing constantly that could affect them. In a down cycle for automotives generally, does that benefit Lithia in terms of more and more dealerships are kind of now for sale that previously haven't been?
Ultimately, it can be a share gain opportunity. Yes. I mean, further consolidating the industry, deploying more capital at those types of multiples can be a very attractive proposition. It is interesting. The auto dealers, they tend to be followed by the same sell side analysts as the manufacturers. And for the most part, they're treated by those analysts as being just a way to do channel checks, a way to check on the company's, the OEM's volumes and market share gains. And there's something of an afterthought. And they tend to place the same type of earnings multiple on the auto dealers as they do on the manufacturers, which I don't think makes sense based on the fundamentals, but which is reasonably common. And they trade similarly volatilely, where the stocks act as if they are very cyclical businesses. But you look back, the companies were profitable through the GFC, right? You have this whole host of ways that they monetize customers that are not just the new vehicle sale, that enable quite a bit of stability. And by and large, you have variable operating costs, right? You're talking about salespeople. And as far as any industry downturn is concerned, there are offsets. I mean, if you have tariffs raising the prices of new vehicles, that will flow through to used vehicles in the same way that the shortages during COVID drove enhanced used vehicle margins for a period of time there. And so the stock price behavior doesn't, in a lot of cases, seem to tie with the fundamentals.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to shift to our wrap-up questions here. I've got two for you. So the first one, I asked this to Bill as well. And when I asked him, it's basically biggest investing mistake or lesson that you've had. And Bill mentioned some of the financials exposure during the GFC. Seeing as you joined Harris after the GFC, I imagine your answer will be a little bit different. So what would you say is the biggest quote-unquote investing mistake you've made over your career, and what lessons did you take away from that?
Yeah, I guess I had my own version of the GFC early on, which is that I started covering energy. I was a generalist, but energy was a focal point. And then we had 2014 Thanksgiving when OPEC decided to flood the market, and we ended up in this awful bear market that went through 2016. And the big mistake that I made was really, I think it was anchoring and doubling down, maybe falling for this notion that you have to make it back the way you lost it, right? And this is a very difficult job. If you're right, 65% of the time, you are going to produce an incredible track record over the years. But it also means you are going to be wrong 35% of the time. And for most people getting into this, you're coming from a world where you got A's on tests, right? You're used to 90-something percent, and 65 doesn't feel very good. And I do think there's a challenge that a lot of new investors have, which is, how do you balance protecting your ego with thinking clearly and doing the right thing for clients? And nobody realizes that they're doing it. It is subconscious, but you're making decisions that sometimes are likely ego-based. And the important lesson, I think, is you got to learn when you're lying to yourself, right? It is hard to admit even to yourself that you are wrong. But you have to develop a sense for it so you can identify it. And that is one of the beautiful things about the Harris process and the team process. We have this group of people that are going to call your bluff. In isolation, it might take you years to realize that you were lying to yourself, but somebody's going to tell you pretty soon here. And there is a lot of value that comes from that.
Hi.
And it helps people develop, I think, faster than they do in most places.
Okay, last question for you. What is one piece of advice you would give to anyone entering the investment industry today?
Yeah, I would say that first, you have to love it. This is a competitive market. There are a lot of smart people doing this job, and they are going to work very hard. And so if you don't love it, if you don't have the passion, you're not going to win over the long term. And then the second thing I would say is pick the right mentors, pick the right culture. The beautiful thing about this job is that the knowledge is cumulative. The things you learn today will still be useful 40 years from now. I have young kids. They all predictably want to play in the NFL. I try to explain to them that peaking at 27 is not ideal. And you can do something where you can peak at 67, and that is far better. And that's the amazing thing about investing, is that that is the path. And so the important thing to do, I think, is to try to optimize for who you're going to be in your 50s, in your 60s as an investor, and not what your bonus will look like at 25. It's about finding the mentors, finding the culture that's going to help you become greatest investor you can be.
All right, that is going to do it for today. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on this show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. Thank you to Alex for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Ryan.